This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Lead story, page one in the New York Times Sunday, top NASA climate scientist says the Bush administration is trying to stop him from speaking out on global warming. The scientist, James E. Hansen, NASA's number one climate watcher, who says he's been muzzled on a dire threat facing the planet. The media James Hansen was trying to talk to? Well, yes, it was NPR, as the Times reported. But more specifically, it was us, On Point. Today he will, on the danger of a different planet being inevitable soon without dramatic action, on the danger of politics cutting the public off from the warnings of their own scientists. Up next on Point, NASA's top climate scientist, unmuzzled. We'll be joined by Dr. Hansen in just a moment, but first we turn to Andrew Revkin. He is environment reporter for the New York Times, where Hansen's charge of muzzling broke last Sunday. He joins us from Garrison, New York. Andrew Revkin, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on the show, Tom.
How did this story come out, and what's being charged here?
Well, Hansen has complained of this sort of muzzling before. What was new and significant this time is he had a lot of support from people at NASA who, normally the kind of people who are invisible, they're in the background, mid-level public affairs officials and other scientists who are not as high profile as he went on the record in my story to say, to detail how this pressure was applied to him.
Remind us of the speech that Jim Hansen gave in December that was kind of the background to this, the latest warning that he fired off.
Well, he's gotten into terrain that the administration doesn't feel scientists should stray into, government scientists. In other words, he was saying, here's the science, here's the trajectory if we stay on our current course, and here are some things we might be able to do about it. And he has had a group researching options for things like restricting emissions of greenhouse gases linked to warming and looking at vehicle emissions and what you can do through auto efficiency right now that might be able to slow the curve, the rise of the curve, that kind of thing. And again, for the Bush administration, they've drawn a bright line in the sand they want their scientists to tread, which is be policy relevant but policy neutral. And he says you can't do that anymore, especially with climate. The intersection is unavoidable. You can't talk about the science without talking about these trajectories, and that's what's gotten him in their radar.
NASA says, and you reported, we've heard it directly as well, they did not muzzle James Hansen. They just asked him to go through channels, to go through proper procedures before talking to the media. Does that wash?
Well, here's where the intermediaries come in. They say that there's never been a formal directive, a written directive saying thou shalt always consult with your superiors first, alert them to media requests, and that the superiors at NASA would have the right to stand in for you in an interview. That stuff's never been memorialized, they say, and now it was always sort of verbal orders coming down from the headquarters in Washington, and that's what everyone's been bridling at. They say, if you want to do this, fine, but put it on paper, and that hadn't really happened. Now, this week, there was an advisory that went out as an email saying all of these things, and but it's been something the administration apparently hasn't wanted to memorialize.
Andrew Revkin, now we've got the House Committee on Science, chaired by Republican New York Congressman Sherwood Bollert, looking at this, firing off a letter just in this week to NASA saying any effort to censor federal scientists biases public discussions of scientific issues, increases distrust of the government, and makes it difficult for the government to attract the best scientists. Is NASA in trouble on this?
Well, we'll see. The staff at that committee are not eager for this to result in a hearing. You know, it is a Republican-headed committee still, even though he's very moderate and very interested in scientific integrity. I think this probably will not result in a hearing, even though I'm still this week have been getting more, many more scientists have come to me this week with some other allegations that I'm still investigating, both at NASA and at other agencies dealing with climate change.
You've written in the past about the tension between the scientific community and the Bush administration. Give us some sense of the larger envelope around this.
It all comes back to what I said a few minutes ago, which is that many scientists in this field have been working for a long time studying the increasing human influence on the climate system. So you simply can't talk about the science anymore without talking about the implications and the need to act promptly to mitigate risks. And there are some who are pushing farther than others, and most of the ones who've gone public have been people like Jim Hansen, who have a career behind them and stature. What's starting to happen now, at least in the reporting I've been doing, is that the invisible ones are coming forward as well and providing documents that help prove that this kind of sifting of the science, choosing the science that suits your policy and stifling the science that doesn't, but there's evidence, more and more evidence across government that this kind of trend has been happening.
Now, more trouble at NASA reported today, this from a different angle. The Washington Post reporting that the NASA Inspector General Robert Cobb, there's an FBI-led watchdog agency, has opened an investigation into multiple complaints from inside NASA that they've failed to investigate safety violations and retaliation is there against whistleblowers. Is there a sense that NASA has been politicized in recent years, Andrew?
Yeah, indeed. Many people within the NASA bureaucracy feel that it's been stacked. Influential offices particularly have been stacked with political appointees more than has been the case in the past. And again, the White House says this is just their effort to exert consistent control over things and keep themes in order and all that. But within the NASA universe, which is a big one, there's a lot of resistance and there's a lot of feeling that this is really just to control, to put a happy face on everything.
In your story, you quote Leslie McCarthy, a public affairs officer who works directly with Dr. Hansen at the Goddard Institute, NASA's Goddard Institute, saying that her superior, George Deutsch, called NPR the most liberal media outlet in the country. I don't know what that has to do with getting scientific information out. And that she says, that his job was to make the president look good, with the implication that Dr. Hansen's view might not help in that effort.
Yeah, well, there you go. And he's a presidential appointee, and fresh out of college, just in 2003, his resume indicates that he essentially worked deep in the Bush re-election campaign. That was his one career step before going to NASA in this position. And the scientists there greatly have, not just Ms. McCarthy, but others have been very upset about some of his efforts to control the flow of information.
Well, here we are, and we at On Point, right in the thick of it. We were the ones who asked in December for an interview with James Hansen. We'll finally get that in just a moment. Andrew Revkin with the New York Times, thanks for all your reporting. Thanks for being with us today.
And thanks for having me on. It's been a pleasure.
Andrew Revkin, environment reporter for the New York Times. We're joined now from New York City by Dr. James E. Hansen. He is director of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies. He's adjunct professor at Columbia University's Department of Earth and Environmental Sciences. James Hansen, thank you very much, finally, for being with us.
Hi, Tom. I'm glad to be here.
Well, here we are. You found yourself in the middle of quite a rumble. We want to look at that rumble and what's happening today. Let me just ask you straight up, have you been censored? Have you been muzzled?
Let me first make a disclaimer. You know, what I say today will be my personal views, and they're based on my few decades of research experience, but I'm not representing NASA or the government in today.
Fair enough. We see that, and yet we're the citizens. We pay the taxes, I guess, including your salary, and we kind of want to know what's going on.
Yeah, that's a good point. Now, I'd like to make one comment with regard to what Andy said.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little more than just whether or not these regulations have been written down or not.
That is, regulations on when and how you can speak outside
right.
of your office.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, for example, after my talk, there were requests from your station mm-hmm. to interview me, and I was told that I cannot respond to that. Instead, I have to tell headquarters about it, and they have the right of first refusal. They can put someone else up to do the interview instead of me, which they offered to do.
Yes, which is what they offered. We declined. We wanted to speak to you.
Yeah. There was no one there who could discuss what was in my talk, so it simply is a method of stopping things from being said that they don't want to be said. And I don't know if this violates the law, although I'm really uncertain about that. It seems to me that it's possibly unconstitutional, but in any case, it makes it seem like we're more like the old Soviet Union than the United States of America.
But Dr. Hansen, NASA responds, they read a written statement to us saying NASA is committed to open and full communications. They just want everybody to go through procedures. No exceptions, you included.
Well, that's not an accurate description of what's happening when we want to talk about global warming. And I think that the public has the right to know. And I think that a democracy assumes that we have a well-informed public and that the information coming from the scientists is the best scientific opinion they can give. And I think that that is not the case now. I think there are examples not only in NASA but in NOAA and EPA where the information has been filtered. And I think this is just a critical issue for our nation.
We're going to talk about the essence of what you've been trying to say, but let me ask you first, are you talking with us with permission today, or are you now off the reservation?
I'm speaking, as I say, as a my personal opinion. Until I get an instruction in writing that tells me I can't talk to you, I'm going to continue to speak out.
James Hansen, I wish you'd give us, so we understand what's kind of in the heart and in the middle of all this, the essence of the warning that you're making, the warning that brought the muzzle on. What was it that you said in December that got attention in the scientific community, that got our attention, and that's got you, it looks like, in the hot seat?
Well, first of all, I made clear that the evidence is very strong that global warming is already beginning. You know, we've had a warming of 1.4 degrees Fahrenheit in the past century. Most of that, about 1 degree, is in the past 30 years. And, you know, 1.4 degrees, that's still a moderate amount of warming. That's much less than the weather fluctuations that occur from day to day and even the monthly average fluctuations. This January was 9 degrees above normal in New York City. It's only enough that you can see the effect if you look at the statistics. The probability that we will have a warmer than normal season, a very warm season, used to be 30% 30 years ago. Now it's about 60%. So, and if you look at certain things which integrate over climate change, then you can see the effects more clearly. For example, mountain glaciers all around the world are melting, and the sea ice in the Arctic is about 25% reduced, less than it was 30 years ago.
You described driving east from, after getting your PhD from Iowa, I guess, in 1967, you went to Goddard. 25 years ago, you started raising the alarm on global warming very early on in scientific awareness of it. You turned out to be pretty much spot on. In December, we read you. What turned our head was you're saying, we may be nearing a tipping point for the biggest change in climate in 500,000 years that would leave us with a different planet, and that if we don't act in this decade, which is increasingly growing short, it may be inevitable. Have we got you right on that?
What I did was compare two scenarios. One of them we call business as usual scenario. That would be continued growth of the emissions of greenhouse gases, which in the past 10 years, CO2 emissions increased 2% per year. Mm. If we continue on that path, in another 10 years, that's a 25% increase in the rate of emissions of CO2. That path ends up with a warming of 2.5 or 3 degrees Celsius before the end of the century, which is about 5 degrees Fahrenheit. And that would imply enormous planetary changes.
Describe that for us. What do you mean by a different planet? You note, I'm sorry, Dr. Hansen, but you note that the first line in the NASA mission is, quote, to understand and protect our home planet. So when you talk about it becoming a different planet, what do you mean?
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned the first line of our mission, because that's the reason why I think I would not be doing my job if I did not speak out, because, you know, understanding this is one thing, but if we don't tell anybody about it, it doesn't mean much. But, for example, that would mean that the Arctic would not have any sea ice in the summer or fall. So obviously the wildlife that lives there, like polar bears and the seals on sea ice, a reindeer on the frozen tundra, those wildlife and that whole ecosystem would not survive, and the indigenous peoples would not be able to carry on with their ways of life. There may be some benefits of that. You can then drive oil, float oil tankers or ships across the Arctic easily, but I think, so it's up to people to decide what's important.
And we may have but some thinking right now, well, that's bad, but I can live with that as long as life goes on, as the economy goes on where I am.
Yeah.
But what about now, the rest of the planet?
Yeah, that's what I've become particularly concerned about is the stability of the ice sheets on Greenland and West Antarctica. Because if you look at the history of the Earth, the last time it was 2.5 or 3 degrees warmer was in the middle Pliocene, about 3 million years ago. And at that time, sea level was at least 25 meters higher. That's 80 feet higher. If you're on the East Coast and you know something about geology, you may notice what's called the Orangeburg Scarf, which is the shoreline that existed 3 million years ago. It's about 100 kilometers inland. And Florida was underwater at that time.
And now we're hearing scientists talk about a rise of just 20 feet, meaning swamping the southern third of Florida, that's Miami and a whole lot more, swamping Manhattan up to the middle of Greenwich Village. Is that the kind of picture you're sharing?
Yeah. Now, point is that ice sheets do not respond immediately. So if you warm the planet up a few degrees, it'll take a while for the ice sheets to disintegrate. But what's become clear, again, from information that's become available in the last several years, is that ice sheets do respond on timescales of centuries, not millennia. And, for example, 14,000 years ago, during Meltwater Pulse 1A, sea level went up 20 meters in 400 years. That's 1 meter every 20 years. Now, that was the ice sheet that existed in Canada. The present ice sheets are a little bit smaller than that. So we may be talking about a few meters per century, which is, you know, about a foot per decade, once the disintegration gets well underway. At the beginning, things go very slowly because the ice sheet is stiff and you get increased snowfall in the center of the ice sheet. But once that gets underway, it will become out of our control. And at 2.5 or 3 degree warming, we would guarantee that it will become out of our control.
How close are we in time to it floating out of human control, getting away from us?
Well, I compare that scenario, business as usual, with what I call alternative scenario. The alternative scenario, you would keep global warming less than 1 degree Celsius, less than 2 degrees Fahrenheit. That we know is going to still involve climate changes, but it has occurred a few times in the last 500,000 years when the planet was almost that warm. And although there were changes were significant and sea level was a few meters higher, with that kind of forcing, the response time of the ice sheets would be longer. It may take closer to 1,000 years for it to respond most of the way, so that we may, in that time period, figure out ways to even prevent that 3 to 5 meters of sea level change.
But that path, that better path, would depend on doing something. In what time frame? And this gets down to the nub, I think, where the rubber meets the road in resistance to your view.
That is exactly right. And that was the primary conclusion, that if we go another 10 years on business as usual, that means a 25% increase in CO2 emission rate, and it means we would put in place the infrastructure that's producing that CO2, much of it being coal-fired power plants, not sequestering CO2, but just emitting it to the atmosphere.
Sequestering meaning maybe pump it underground or somehow keep it out of the atmosphere.
Right. Mm-hmm. In the future, we may have that technology, but we don't have it now. So if we continue down this path, then it becomes impossible to achieve this alternative scenario, because the alternative scenario assumes that we flatten out our emissions during the next 1 to 2 decades.
And we're not flattening them out right now, you're saying?
No, they're increasing, as I say, 2% per year over the last decade.
Let me ask you, Dr. Hansen, here you are. You're very well placed. You're at the top in NASA of climate research. Why don't you talk to the White House about this? Why are you so determined to reach out to a bigger audience, to the American public?
Well, I think the reason that I think it's essential to reach out to the American public, and, you know, I'm not supposed to talk about policy, I try to look at these different scenarios and say, here's what we get with this scenario, here's what we get with that scenario, and then the politics of what we do, that's up to the people.
But the NASA mission to understand and protect the home planet.
Right. So therefore, we have to provide the information, and we have to do it with a clarity. And I think the problem with my talk in San Francisco was that I connected the dots all the way from emissions to the changes in the atmosphere and to the effects that will occur during the next century. And that begins to get too uncomfortably close to politics. But I'm trying to stay out of the politics, but it's hard for me not to notice that the reason we haven't got on to the track of the alternative scenario is that there are special interests which resist the kind of changes that we would need. I gave a talk at ExxonMobil headquarters to a group of all of the major automobile manufacturers, executives, and engineers. I described these two scenarios, and I suggested, well, why don't you can see that this is going to be affecting your industry. Why don't you try to get ahead of the curve and start emphasizing high efficiency automobiles and, you know, get ahead of the other manufacturers and the rest of the world? And the answer was, Dr. Hansen, we have to give the consumers what they want. And the consumers want bigger vehicles, more power, higher performance vehicles. They don't want efficient automobiles.
And they may soon have an ocean in their laps. James Hansen, you've spoken about your own grandchildren when it comes to the way you're speaking out, the way you're standing up. What was the connection?
Well, yeah. In thinking about whether I was going to speak up or not, brought me to this conclusion was I don't want in the future my grandchildren to say, Opa understood what was going to happen, but he didn't make it clear. And so I'm trying to make it clear.
Your public affairs officer interpreted her higher-ups as saying that their job was to make the president look good, not necessarily to get your opinion out to the public. Do you see, and I know this is maybe thin ice for you, but do you see that direct a kind of a political interest in putting the muzzle on you?
Could you repeat that question?
All right. do you see what you've called your muzzling, what you've called your censoring, as a political act by the Bush administration?
What I see is an increasing control of what scientists are able to say, and this there are political appointees in the public affairs office, which from the top it seems all the way down, and it's much more extensive now than it was several years ago. You know, I think the attempts to influence what comes out of the agencies has probably existed in all administrations, Democrat and Republican. But I have never seen it anywhere nearly this strong as it has been in the past few years.
Are you afraid for your job, for your position as you speak with us right now? Are other less senior scientists afraid?
Yeah, I'm concerned, and I've, in the last few days, been talking to counsel. I don't want to do anything which risks my job. But I think what's more important is the fact that scientists throughout the agencies where I've talked to scientists, and that means NOAA and EPA as well as NASA.
NOAA, National Oceanographic, and please help me on that one.
Yeah, National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration.
That's right, yep.
So for example, last summer we had this unusual string of hurricanes.
We noticed.
And the question is global warming involved in that? Well, we didn't have the chance for an honest scientific discussion of that because the NOAA controlled most of the media interaction at that time. The National Hurricane Center is under NOAA.
Mm-hmm.
And NOAA has took a position, an agency position, that there was no relationship between global warming and hurricanes. Well, that's probably not right. This is a scientific issue which is being investigated now. And certainly global warming is only one of the factors involved. And we just had really bad luck this last summer where some of the hurricanes hit the warm loops right before they hit land, so they were very strong when they hit land. But nevertheless, there is considerable evidence that global warming is a significant factor in hurricane intensity. And the temperature of the Atlantic Ocean in the region of hurricane formation has been about half a degree Celsius warmer during the past 11 years when we've had very strong hurricanes as compared to the preceding 25 years.
James Hansen, what about the depth of concern about the relationship between our public discourse and science at bottom? Is there a disconnect emerging?
Well, yeah, the public needs to know. The public is not stupid. And, you know, the funny thing is that the politicians would be much better off if they allowed the scientific method to be used. And to do that, you must present both sides of an issue. You must look at it without prejudice. You must look at all the evidence and then make your decision. So if you filter that evidence, you're not only fooling the public, but you're fooling yourself. And your decisions are not going to be optimum decisions. And I just think that's a very important point.
And do you think that the American government and the American public are getting filtered, politically filtered science right now?
Well, I only can speak to the science that I'm dealing with. And in that case, I've given you evidence that the evidence on global warming is definitely being filtered.
Let's get a call from East Lansing, Michigan. Mary's on the line. Hi, Mary. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
We're good. What do you think, Mary?
Well, I think that the issue really is the public reaction to the information that they get, because I think what frightens me a little bit is the collective memory that the general population has with regard to things that affect them, you know, and what Dr. Hansen has been talking about. You know, for instance, I live in Michigan, and the winters are now warmer, and everybody's kind of like, oh, isn't that nice? But reality is, and I think about this, is that there's a reason the winters are warmer, and it's a little bit, makes me a little nervous, you know. And I think if we had something like a Hurricane Katrina happen, maybe we would be a little bit more cautious and put more pressure on individuals, say, you know, politicians, what have you, to help affect some of these changes that need to be made. I mean, I also live in a state which is greatly affected by the automotive industry, and I drive a foreign automobile because I think it gets better gas mileage, it's more efficient. But I see a million SUVs on the road next to me.
Mary, do you think that population of SUVs or that American sort of views of what's going on in the world would be different if there was a different flow of scientific conversation?
Well, I think, I mean, I read the article in the Times. I get the Times, you know, every week, on every Sunday. I was really intrigued by the article. I commend and applaud Dr. Hansen's efforts. I think that, you know, I think the information is available to certain, you know, groups, pockets of people. You know, I just think it certainly is frightening, the amount of censorship and thuggery that goes on with this administration. And I think that, you know, what it really comes down to is when the public gets the information, as long as they do get it, how will they react and what will they do to affect the changes that need to be made?
But that starts with getting the information. Mary, thank you very much. Sorry, Mary, thanks very much for your call. We've got so many callers here. Let me get another one from Charleston, South Carolina. Jeanette is calling. Hi, Jeanette, you're on the air.
Thank you very much.
You're quite welcome.
Yes, my annuals have turned into perennials, so the planet is definitely changing.
Mm.
I was curious, as Dr. Hansen spoke to his lawyer, if we have any basis for which we, the people, can sue this administration or the government so we can get truthful and accurate information.
I mean, does it come to that? Do we have to sue to get truthful and accurate information?
Sir, it seems to be the case. Yes, it does.
Jeanette, I don't know how James Hansen will deal with that, but Jim, what do you say?
Well, I'm just trying to do the things that will allow me to continue to speak out. I don't have any interest in getting back at anyone. I just would like to be able to say what I know.
And that has been the rub. That's been the issue. I want to listen and talk about solutions here a little bit, or at least what's on the table, and share with us what you can. We don't get you every day, and we understand that you're not the policymaker, but we want the value of your view. President Bush, of course, spoke this week in his State of the Union address about the environment, not directly about global warming, but about how we use energy in this country. I wish you'd listen to 30, 40 seconds of this with us, James Hansen, and give us whatever response you can. Here's the president.
So tonight I announced the Advanced Energy Initiative, a 22% increase in clean energy research at the Department of Energy to push for breakthroughs in two vital areas. To change how we power our homes and offices, we will invest more in zero-emission coal-fired plants, revolutionary solar and wind technologies, and clean, safe nuclear energy. We must also change how we power our automobiles. We will increase our research in better batteries for hybrid and electric cars and in pollution-free cars that run on hydrogen. We will also fund additional research in cutting-edge methods of producing ethanol, not just from corn, but from wood chips and stalks or switchgrass.
And there's the litany. There's an agenda. It sounds like a big one. James Hansen, you've said we've got about 10 years to turn this around, or we face a tipping point that could be really disastrous. Do you hear a program sufficiently ambitious to turn around the climate problems you're describing in the president's litany there?
I think that I can answer that question. You know, I'm not supposed to say this policy is good or bad,
and mm-hmm.
but what I can do is tell you the effect of those policies on the scenarios that I'm talking about.
Okay.
The alternative scenario, I've said it needs to level out, flatten out our emissions the next decade or two, and then get them to decline significantly before mid-century.
And presumably that means going at vehicle emissions and power plant emissions, but how do you see it?
And these things that he mentioned will be very useful for the latter part of that job, namely getting the decline. Sequestration of CO2, he mentioned, zero-emission coal-fired power plants. I think that's very important because coal is at the moment, our largest potential source of energy. Mm-hmm. And if we're going to use that, we had better use it in that way. And likewise on vehicles, well, hydrogen may or may not pan out to be the best way. Plug-in hybrids look right now to be a very effective way to reduce vehicle emissions.
What's a plug-in hybrid?
That's a hybrid vehicle in which you plug it in to the electrical outlet when you're at home, and you can get the first 30 miles or whatever, depending on how good your battery is,
off the grid,
using strictly electric.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then you switch it over to a hybrid.
Okay.
And as batteries get better, you know, that 30 miles will become longer. So that could be a huge improvement in efficiency.
So when you tote these up, does it add up to what we need to do?
Now, the problem is that we need changes in the next decade. And where those could come in both vehicles and in the requirements for power plants is from improved efficiencies. There's tremendous potential in efficiency. In vehicles, the National Research Council has said we could get a 30% improvement with technology that exists now, but we need to require that. You know, in the late 1970s, we required a change in an improvement in efficiency from 13 to 24 miles per gallon. That made a huge difference. If we had a 30% improvement in efficiency of vehicles, that would, by the time the new vehicles had penetrated the market, would save $100 billion per year in oil if it's $50 a barrel. And integrated over a 35-year period, it would save seven times the amount of oil that is estimated to exist by the U.S. Geological Survey in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. So it's a huge amount, and we should be doing a better job of improving the energy efficiency, not only in vehicles, but in electricity use.
But those steps aren't on this list, and you're saying time is running out. So are we still on the drastic
again,
path
now,
here?
I'm not, I don't want to specify policy, but there was a bipartisan energy commission which did a really a thorough job of looking at this, and they showed that not only in the case of vehicles, but in the case of the other energy uses, that we could level out our energy use if we really had a significant effort on energy efficiency, and there are all sorts of other advantages in doing that.
But that's an if. That's not a we're on track. Ronak's calling from Boston. Hi, Ronak. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you doing?
We're well. What do you think, Ronak?
I'm an astronomer myself, and listening to Dr. Hansen's concerns about this are really fascinating. So I think this is a great show. Just one quick comment and one quick question. The first comment is I think we're all preaching to the choir. You're getting a lot of phone callers who either listen to your show or read the New York Times, and I think there's a little bit of a bias.
Well, we've got a lot of other callers and listeners out there as well. But maybe
we'll fill in the gaps here, but I think the question needs to be put politically succinctly. Dr. Hansen, when you think of the science you do, you and I share a lot of the same background in physics, geology, et cetera, and chemistry, you think of the people who are some of the biggest supporters of this current administration. Do you really think, in your honest opinion, that a socially conservative president, whose biggest supporters are social conservatives, don't believe the universe is older than 6,000 years and reject even a lot of the scientific findings about evolution, Big Bang Theory, which I'm uniquely involved with as an astronomer? Do you really think you're going to get the kind of support from this government, from this administration, that you really need?
Ronak, it's a big question. Jim Hansen?
Well, there are some people who you'll never have an influence on, but then there are, the way a democracy works, there's a fraction in the middle, and they're the ones that can make a difference. And I think even within this administration, I think there are people who recognize maybe our automobile industry would be healthier and better off if they made some fundamental changes. So I think that there's a chance, and I don't think we should give up and say we can't convince people to make a change. We have to try.
Jim Hansen, as I recall, you tangled with Democrat Al Gore in the past. Is this really a liberal or conservative issue?
I don't think so. I think that conservatives, and even the strongly religious people feel that they should preserve the planet, the creation, you know. So I don't think it should be a political issue.
If we call back in a few months, are you still going to be there, Jim Hansen? Or does this conversation send you
well,
on your way out the door?
I don't know.
Seriously?
I thought about it, you know, and I think that I can be demoted very easily, but I don't think I can be fired easily without a really good cause. And I think they would have a hard time identifying one that would allow me to be completely dispensed with.
James Hansen, we appreciate your honesty. We appreciate your speaking up. We hear you as a fellow citizen, as a grandparent, as a scientist. We're grateful to you for speaking with us today. Thanks very much for finally closing the loop with us.
It was nice to be here.
James Hansen, NASA's top climate scientist, director of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies, says he's been muzzled, but not today. Listeners, you can continue this conversation. You can download the On Point podcast. You can subscribe to our daily newsletter, all at our website, onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Eileena Mata, Stefano Katsonis, Matt Lieber, Tanja Raleigh, James Ross, Christina Russo, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Matt Odette and Angel Cozzelli. Our senior producer is Joe O'Connor. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.